Southeast 8th Avenue Studios. This is Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Good morning. We got a Thursday morning going at a minute before 9 o'clock. We're about an hour away from Air Cascadia. Join us for headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And then at 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints, today honoring the life and times of noted Native American poet and spoken word artist John Trudell. The programming includes an excerpt from a broadcast John Trudell did from Alcatraz in 1969. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Lynn Molick speaks with author Todd Davies about her latest book, The Lizard Princess, the third volume in the Arcadia Wonder Tales series. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, Barry Deutsch unveils his new graphic novel, the third in the Hereville series. It's called How Mirka Caught a Fish. That's all coming up after Teresa Mitchell hosts an hour of Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. That is next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Fiesta Flamenca Navideña on Friday and Saturday, December 11th and 12th at 7 p.m. at the Headwaters Theater in Portland. Fiesta Flamenca Navideña will celebrate the season in flamenco style with performances by Three Shine Flamenco, Stomptown Flamenco, Coro Navideño, and more. Again, that's Fiesta Flamenca Navideña, Friday and Saturday, December 11th and 12th at 7 p.m. at the Headwaters Theater, 55 Northeast Farragut Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of music, nature, and storytelling, an experiential weekend workshop from January 8th through the 10th at Cedar Ridge Retreat and Conference Center in Vernonia, Oregon. Storytelling as a practice broadens our perspective and helps us understand the significance of our experiences. This workshop teaches the roots of storytelling and delves into the storyteller's mind. No prior experience required, and the deadline for registration is December 18th. Again, that's Music, Nature, and Storytelling, a weekend workshop January 8th through the 10th at Cedar Ridge Retreat in Vernonia, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know, giving you the tools to destroy billionaire rule. Gonna go to headlines here. And then I'm going to talk about oxygen. And this is going to be a heavy one, folks. You need oxygen. And someone's taking it away from you, and you need to know who and how and why. And I'm really serious about this. I'm talking about oxygen. Anyway, two headlines. Buenos Aires marches and demonstrations today to say goodbye to President Cristina Fernandez. This will mark the handover of presidential power in Argentina. The historic Plaza de Mayo Square in front of the Casa Rosada will be the stage for three protests, and a fourth demonstration will take place outside Congress when Cristina Fernandez hands over the presidency to Mauricio Macri, who will take over the office at Casa Rosada. Now, I've been there. This information is from Radio Havana, Cuba, and it's a pretty big plaza. But these demos tend to be loud and very large. Been there for a demo, too. Was quite impressed. And the reason this is news is trouble brewing. Anyway, they write, for the last 2 weeks, supporters of the president have called for demonstrations through social media to say goodbye to the president at Plaza de Mayo. The head of state will preside over her last executive activity in the government palace, unveiling a sculpture in homage to the late President Nestor Kirchner, her husband, which will accompany those of Raul Alfonsín and Hector Campora at the Casa Rosada's Gallery of Busts. We have one of those at the White House, you know. On Thursday morning, organizations that strongly supported the outgoing president, including La Campora, Unidos y Organizados, Movement Evita, among others, are expected to gather at 10 a.m. in front of the Congress, and who knows what will come down. So you can find out more from that at Radio Havana Cuba, RHC, let's see, rhc.cu/en. From the soccer.is, the shooting down of the Russian Sukhoi 24 jet sends a powerful message to Russia, meaning we, the West, are ready to risk a war to push you back. Are you ready to go to war? The painful answer will be that no. Russia is not prepared to wage a war against the entire empire over Syria simply because she does not have the capabilities to do so. Now, I should tell you that this website, The Soccer, is sympathetic towards Russia and towards the Donbass region, trying to break away from or at least get some space from the rest of Ukraine. And so this writer says that Syria is beyond the Russian power projection capability, roughly 1,000 kilometers, especially if that power projection has to be executed through hostile territory, which Turkey most definitely is. So far, the Russians have succeeded brilliantly to organize and support their small force in Syria. But that in no way indicates a Russian capability to support a major air operation over Syria or even less so a ground operation. The fact is that the Russian intervention in Syria always was a risky and difficult one, and it did not take the empire much time to capitalize on this. And he also says that Russia cannot protect Syria from the U.S., at least not in purely military terms. This does not mean that Russia does not have retaliatory options. Russia is already engaged in the following. First, economic sanctions. Russia has declared a number of sanctions against Turkey, including the freezing of the Turkish Stream project. That's the, I think that's the gas pipeline. It's either oil or gas. Furthermore, Russian tourism in Turkey, a huge source of revenue, is most likely to dwindle down to a tiny amount compared to what it used to be. Russians will not be banned from going to Turkey, but no tours or packages will be offered by Russian travel agencies. Some Russian goods will be banned in Russia, etc. Secondly, political sanctions. In Russia, they will use one of their most terrifying weapons, the truth. The Russian military presents, and this is the soccer.is writing this, presents a devastating series of photos and videos shot by Russian air and space assets, proving that Turkey does indeed purchase oil from Daesh, ISIS. What was especially shocking about this evidence is that it showed the truly immense scale of the smuggling. One photo showed 1,722 oil trucks in the Deir ez-Zor region, while another showed 8,500 oil tankers used by Daesh to transport up to 200,000 barrels of oil. What these figures mean is that not only is this smuggling organized at the level of the Turkish state, but it's absolutely obvious that the USA, which also has satellites, knows everything about it. Predictably, the Western media made no mention of the actual evidence. It only spoke of the images the Russians claim to show. But the damage is still done, especially in the long term. Now everybody with a modicum of intelligence knows that Erdogan is a lying crook. More importantly, it has become undeniable that Turkey is not only an ally, but a patron and sponsor of ISIS-Daesh. Finally, in the light of this evidence, it becomes rather obvious why Turkey decided to shoot down the Russian Sukhoi 24 jet, because the Russians were bombing the Daesh to Turkey smuggling routes. The final blow to the prestige and credibility of Erdogan in Turkey came from Putin himself, who in his annual address to Parliament said, I'm not going to read that, blah, 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 said Putin. Of course, in a society, he writes, thoroughly habituated to lying, dishonesty, and hypocrisy, these are only words and they will be ignored. But in the Middle East and the rest of the world, these are powerful words which the Turks will have a very hard time washing off from their reputation. He also writes, there are limited but not irrelevant military measures. Russia has now admitted that their S-400 anti-aircraft missiles, which are the latest, most advanced, and fastest, they're now in Syria. Russia has begun building a second air base, this time in Shayat in central Syria. This base is built, been bringing in a few Russian AWACS, or MiG-31s would make sense. Third, Russia will now use more modern Su-34 aircraft equipped with advanced air-to-air missiles in northern Syria, and Russian strike aircraft will now be escorted by Sukhoi 30 fighters. The combination of measures will make it harder for the Turks to repeat such an attack. He writes, I personally doubt they have any such intentions, at least in the immediate future. And there's more, much more on that. You can get it at thesoccer.is. I may return to it depending. But I want to skip ahead because, I mentioned last week the problem with oxygen, but it went by kind of quickly. I thought it was rather dramatic. And then when I looked back on it, I thought, no, I just said this little thing about oxygen. And it, when I listened to it myself, I think that's not really getting the point across. Global warming is advancing much more rapidly than most people understand. It's advancing right now. I've often said that it's the nature of scientists to be conservative in what they say, and that's how they should be. I'm fine with that. But we are in the midst of a terrible, terrible crisis and catastrophe, and it has to do with oxygen. And there are two ways. And this is what I want to emphasize. I've been talking about the clathrate gun since 94. When it first came up, got my attention. Seemed like a distant and improbable thing then, the clathrate gun being the sudden release of now trapped methane reserves called clathrates. There are other forms of methane. And now in 2015, we find that in fact, methane is roaring into the atmosphere from multiple sources. We have a methane problem, and methane, I'll have more on that in a moment, but that's the first source of displacing. It displaces, there's so much of it, it displaces oxygen. And it can severely displace oxygen, and it can create a very rapid crisis. I'm talking about within our lifetimes. And it may be talking about something that would happen very, very suddenly once a certain threshold is passed. Like global warming itself, the methane problem is self-feeding. But that's just one threat to oxygen. That's one of the threats to oxygen. Displacement by methane. The other one is the cessation of the production of major part of the world's oxygen by phytoplankton in the oceans. Now, you need details for me to make these claims and for you to understand just how extreme the situation is right now. And so I'm going to go into those details. And then I will ask for your calls, asking you what you think should be done about it. And I will give some hints as to what I think should be done about it. Right now, the Conference of Parties in Paris is failing to produce an adequate trillions-dollar regime for the immediate reversal of catastrophic global climate change. As this multilateral evasion stunt moves forward, you may have been lulled into the idea that something substantial is going to be changed, or that dangerous climate events are too far into the future for you to concern yourself. This is certainly not the case. They're talking millions and billions of dollars. The change that needs to happen would be on the level of trillions. The biggest players in the Parisian hotel suites are not government climate reformers, although that's who is there. But it is the people behind them, the CEOs of the oil, gas, coal, war, and finance industries. Their will shall be done, and their overwhelming desire is to put this whole global healing push on a shelf where it can be guarded 24/7 and their profits can be protected instead. That's what they're about, and that's what they do. They will fight to the end to stay super rich. Here's an example of the sort of bovine byproduct you're expected to swallow about the Paris talks. It comes from The Guardian, I'm sorry to say, by way of Nigel Purvis. He writes, quote, the United States' refusal to make internationally binding its ambitious pollution targets at the COP21 climate talks in Paris isn't a sign of Barack Obama's lack of political will, but a reflection of the legal limits of his authorities and the political realities of what other nations will commit to doing. And he writes, Obama has proposed a legally binding agreement applicable to all nations without binding emissions targets. That approach isn't ideal, but it's politically and legally achievable, and a massive step forward for climate action. Makes me furious. I like breathing. I think I'll just have a nice breath right now, so I can calm down a little bit. Okay, so this is bunk. Not only is it not ideal, not only is this agreement not ideal, it's fairly useless. Suppose you were trapped. Let me use a metaphor here. Suppose you were trapped at the bottom of a muddy 50-foot deep pit. You just fell down there. You got no food, no water. Nobody knows you're down there. So you got to get out. And you discover that working all day, you can create a foothold that will lift you 2 feet up. Well, this means that you can create another foothold. So you get to work on that one. I mean, you're getting hungry and thirsty. Assuming that you will expire like most people without food or water after a few days, the most you can hope for is to create several footholds, getting you several feet up, a portion of the way up to the top, where you will die. In such a situation, you cannot say that your foothold plan is viable progress. It's no good. You can see that you can get a little higher, so what? So, despite Nigel's optimism, the Guardian article is an exposition of a disaster. Here's more of it. Here's a quote from the Guardian article. And as I was saying, this is what you're exposed. This is the way you're supposed to frame things. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has led the effort to discredit Obama's efforts in Paris, backed by a powerful apparatus of fossil fuel funded climate skepticism. Say that three times quickly. And state level Republican opposition to the landmark Clean Power Plan, which would reduce U.S. dependence on dirty coal. McConnell and others have made clear that no international climate agreement would ever be approved by the Senate. Now, as far as that goes, that's perfectly true. These people are useless. Mitch McConnell. You know, if you follow Greg Palast, you understand that Mitch McConnell and the majority, I mean, seriously, the majority, the Republican majority in Congress was brought to you by throwing elections. It's something American people just don't really want to look at. I really don't understand why. I mean, you don't really get that much power from an election. There's so many things you don't get to address, but you do get some power, and what little you had has been stripped away by those corrupt electronic machines and by by gerrymandering and many, many other tricks that the Republicans use to keep minority rule. And that's how they get the majority in Congress, is by election fraud. They yell the other way, look over there at fraud. They think there's these, or they want you to believe that there's these fraudulent hordes that are voting who are not allowed to. That's not the fraud. The fraud is the election itself. And how's that for acknowledging that the U.S. is occupied by monsters? But let's read on, quoting, that credible threat is keeping U.S. climate negotiators from making the pollution targets and Paris Agreement internationally binding, but it's not putting the brakes on the idea of a legally binding agreement. End quote. Oh no, no problem there. Pass the Perrier and let's sign a useless paper. Quote, U.S. law allows its president to approve some international agreements without the Senate. These are called executive agreements, and they are exceptionally common. The United States enters into about 94% of its international agreements this way. The Yalta Agreement in 1945 that helped define the post-Second World War order and the Paris Peace Accords in 1973 that ended the war in Vietnam are examples of this, end quote. Well, this is to be no Yalta. There's more to the article, but I want to skip ahead to quote the conclusion. Quoting, what matters most is that countries back their targets with the force of law domestically. Whereas the international community has no international climate police, the United States government can and does impose fines and even criminal penalties, get that, on polluters that disobey domestic environment laws. If other countries take the same approach, then Paris can succeed despite its imperfections, end quote. Now, if you laughed when you heard that, it's probably because hearing the idea that the U.S. government, which loves its petroleum contributions and which heavily subsidizes the oil and gas industries, and which is, to a large extent, the oil and gas industries. I mean, it's just free. Literally, we give free cash in huge amounts to ExxonMobil, all those companies. If other countries take the same approach, then Paris can succeed despite its imperfections. What nonsense. So if you think that, I mean, you know, that's just a ridiculous idea that the U.S. is going to impose fines and criminal penalties. They're not even going to stop giving away free money to the petroleum industry and the coal industry. Now, if I believe that this conference and its attendant propaganda were a step in the right direction, I might not be so harsh. But there is new information, very serious information, about the effects of global warming that you must know now, because as Naomi Klein says in the title of her book, This Changes Everything, and it's about your breathing. You know, just breathing. No big thing here. Whether you get to breathe. Global warming poses at least two threats to the level of oxygen in the air. When I say the level of oxygen, I mean whether there will be enough in it to live. You are possibly familiar with the first threat. Mentioned it earlier, that of the methane displacement during a runaway global warming event called the clathrate gun hypothesis. I have more information about that scenario. Don't let people poo-poo that, because it's happening right now, and I'll turn to that in a moment. But there's a second threat from the mass death of oxygen-producing phytoplankton in the world's oceans, a phenomenon that has begun now in a big way, and I will also have details on that threat. Taken together, the oxygen threats indicate that all economies must now be overthrown and converted to anti-global warming. Trillions must be expended. No time is to be lost, but hear me out and see if you agree. First, the methane problem. Remember, there's two. First, the methane problem. Methane released by global warming is ongoing, and of course, the more methane is released, the faster heat is trapped in the atmosphere, thereby releasing yet more. It's a vicious cycle. Methane tends to be converted to CO2 in the oceans, adding to acidification, destroying more plant life. Hint of number two. Releasing more methane. Fracking and U.S. maniacal capitalist agriculture practices are also releasing more and more methane. We have a problem now with methane buildup. It's not a future thing. Now, turning to Siberian Times, huge attention has focused, I'm quoting them, has focused on the mysterious large holes that have suddenly appeared in the Siberian Arctic recently, and there's evidence of a similar process underwater in the southern seas, the southern Kara Sea. Large mounds, described as pingos, have been identified on the seabed off the Yamal Peninsula, and their formation is seen as due to the thawing of subsea permafrost, causing a high accumulation of methane gas. These mounds are leaking methane, and their blowout potential poses a significant geohazard to energy exploration in the Arctic waters, according to new research by scientists at the Center for Arctic Gas, Hydrate, Environment, and Climate in Norway, supported by the Federal Subsoil Resources Management Agency of Russia. For example, in a little reported incident 20 years ago during geotechnological drilling by the Russian vessel Bavanit in the Petra Sea, a pingo gas deposit was opened, threatening the ship's safety with a sudden methane release, a process that has been claimed as the cause of the Bermuda Triangle and the Atlantic Ocean. Now I'm going to stop right there and explain what that's all about. First, the fact that these things are called pingos is almost unfortunate. You know, don't let your mind go around to a cute little octopi using eight ping pong paddles each and playing over a little net underwater. That's not what's happening here. Maybe they should be called blammos. Explodos, anyway, but they are called pingos. And what we're talking about here is methane being released under the sea, as in the clathrate gun hypothesis. And this methane is creating hills, huge mounds under the sea. A Russian ship went around, poked a hole in one of them, and released so much methane that it almost sunk the ship. That's how much methane was released. It's just the bubbles that did it. You can't float in bubbles. You can float in water. And so they had to get the hell out of there, and they barely made it. Barely escaped sinking. That's how huge these things are. And as the article goes on to show, these are, in fact, the same as the giant craters that have suddenly appeared in Siberia, and they are methane. Dr. Pavel Serov, lead author of the research, which is published in the Journal of Geophysical Research, said, quote, pingos are intensively discussed in the scientific community, especially in the context of global climate warming. They may be the step before the methane blows out. Once again, I got to stop and frame this. Don't let these words just slide past you. We're talking about the end. The researchers focused on, quote, two subsea pingos that were identified offshore of the very same area of the mysterious Yamal Peninsula craters. The Siberian Times has published the views on scientists. So I'm going to skip ahead on this. Scientists now believe the craters were formed by pingos erupting under the pressure of methane gas released by the thawing of permafrost caused by warming temperatures. Now, I talked about the vicious circle. It's begun. Returning to the article from Siberian Times, now the Norwegian study shows how important methane accumulation is for the formation of subsea pingos. Pardon me. These structures are now found strewn on the ocean floor in the Arctic shallow seas. According to research by CAGE, part of the Arctic University of Norway, that's an acronym, CAGE. Let me see if I can find it. It is Center for Arctic Gas, Hydrate, Environment, and Climate. How you get CAGE out of that, I'm not sure. But anyway, Dr. Pavel Sarov, lead author of the research, said pingos are... Okay, I already said that part. Now, the Norwegian study shows how important methane accumulation is for the formation of subsea pingos. The underwater mounds were between 70 meters and 1,000 meters in diameter. That's, what, 3,200 feet, and had been spotted originally on a seismic study of the area. They rise between 5 and 9 meters above the surrounding sea floor, and overall size they are considerably larger than those found on land in Yamal. Dr. Sarov said the question was, are these mounds submerged terrestrial pingos, or are they something different forming under marine conditions? One of the South Kara Sea pingos was leaking a lot of methane, but where was the methane coming from? As permafrost extends into the ocean, so do the pingos. They even appear in geographical proximity to the ones observed on land. Initially, it was thought the undersea pingos were relics of the Ice Age, but the groundbreaking new research indicates the reverse. According to Professor Meinert, co-author of the paper, he says the study shows these newly discovered subsea pingos may be quite recent. Talking about the clathrate gun disaster now happening, new information, giant blasts of methane under the sea and in Siberia. Returning to Siberian Times. Oh, by the way, you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. If you have comments and questions about this, even though I haven't gotten to the second threat to your oxygen, I invite your calls and questions. 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I'm making the case that in order to survive, we must destroy the billionaire corporate war state. Period. And I would like to see it destroyed peacefully and swiftly. Thanks. That would be the best. Let's see if we can find a way to do that. But my point here is we don't have a choice. If you like breathing, returning to the article from Siberian Times. On land, pingos are mainly formed when the water freezes into an ice core under the soil because of the chilling temperatures of the permafrost. However, subsea pingos may be formed because of the thawing of relict sea, subsea permafrost and dissociation of methane-rich gas hydrates or clathrates. Gas hydrates are ice-like solids composed of, among other things, methane and water. They form and remain stable under a combination of low temperature and high pressure. In permafrost, the temperatures are very low. Gas hydrates are stable even under the low pressure, such as on shallow Arctic seas. Therefore, thawing of permafrost leads to temperature increases, which in turn leads to melting of gas hydrates, releasing the formerly trapped gas. The methane creates the necessary force that pushes the remaining frozen sediment layers upward, forming mounds. Research indicates that subsea pingos, and as I said, they should be called blammos, can potentially blow out without the massive attention that has greeted the land pingo eruptions, which leave craters visible from space in their wake. Yet in the Kara or other Arctic seas, massive expulsions of methane go into the ocean. And departing from the text, of course, when it goes into the ocean, it adds to the acidification of the ocean, which destroys plankton. But I'm not even to the plankton yet. And I'm talking about two severe threats to your oxygen. And I can tell as I'm saying this because, you know, I play this on my own mind. I say, what are you saying, Teresa, that there's a threat to everyone's ability to breathe? Well, I actually am saying that, and I'm very serious. And I am directing you as best I can to the scientific information, which indicates that there is a severe crisis going on right now. And that all of the gentle, let's make a deal, maybe in the future type arrangements that are being done in Paris are useless, 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 useless. From robertscribbler.com, according to the new study published in the journal Nature, increasing ocean temperatures combined with changes in the structure of the Gulf Stream are causing the rapid destabilization of large amounts of methane off the U.S. East Coast. What the study shows is that the Gulf Stream is getting warmer due to human-caused global warming and that the warmth is pushing deeper and deeper into the ocean. As the warmer waters encounter the continental shelf, they begin to affect massive frozen reserves of methane called methane hydrates or clathrates on the seabed. Clathrates are a frozen combination of methane and water. I just said that, so I'll just skip that part. Hundreds of gigatons of methane lay trapped in clathrate in a region affected by the Gulf Stream. If even a fraction of these clathrates were to destabilize it could result in a powerful amplifying feedback to global warming, ocean and atmospheric anoxia, oxygen loss, and worse. The study postulates that the ocean warming of 5 degrees Celsius may have caused a massive release of methane about 50 million years ago, resulting in a large release of methane that caused both widespread ocean acidification and a major increase of 5 to 7 degrees Celsius in world temperatures. The seabed in the region in question is shown to have warmed by about 8 degrees Celsius since the last ice age, with rapid warming occurring since the advent of human greenhouse gas emissions. The study found that an area of 10,000 square kilometers off the East Coast showed rapidly destabilizing clathrates. The total volume at immediate risk of destabilization was 2.5 gigatons. Now, departing from that article again, we're talking gigatons, we're talking methane, we're talking about, we're in the middle of it. People, this is the clathrate burst. And there are actually, you know, I don't do this all the time. I'm a bus driver. I drive my bus. I get tired from driving my bus. I get anxious from being a tranny driving a bus. And I do this in my spare time. And so I was able to pull up several articles. But what I found is that this is a very heavily researched, scientifically studied phenomenon. This is not late night radio scare stuff. This is not, let's see, I've heard it called something porn. How do they say it? Terror porn or something. Not terror, but anyway. Yeah, this is scary, but this is real. And I urge you to look into it yourself. Because I think when you do, you'll be as electrified as I am in understanding that we are now in a terrific and accelerating global warming. It's not something that's going to happen in the future. All this stuff in Paris is too little, too late. Something extremely massive has to happen right now, and it's going to cost trillions of dollars and change everything, as Naomi Klein says, everything. Right now, our economy is based on serving elites who have control of petroleum resources. Now, this has to change immediately, and our economy has to be based on democratic institutions creating an absolute shutdown of the petroleum economy and finding a way to allow transport and heating and cooling and to reverse the situation. That's what we have to do, because we're going to die if we don't. And when I say we're going to die, I mean we're going to choke to death. And when I say we're going to choke to death, I'm not talking about 50 years from now. That's how severe the situation is. And I believe I can back it up down to every sentence. I invite you to call. Go ahead, call and challenge that. 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. As I said, I'm still talking about methane, and I haven't even gotten to the death of the phytoplankton. Two sources of loss of oxygen. Returning to the article from Robert Scribler, an area of 10,000 square kilometers off the East Coast showed rapidly destabilizing clathrates. Total volume was 2.5 gigatons, as I said, because methane is many times as potent as carbon dioxide. In producing global warming, a single release of methane of the size estimated would triple or quadruple the amount of heat forcing produced by human greenhouse gas emissions in how long? 1 year. 1 year. Not 100. Not 10. 1 year. Furthermore, this study focused only on the U.S. East Coast as a potential methane source. Other studies have found large methane releases coming from the Alaskan Continental Shelf, the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, and other regions of the Arctic. This is the first major mid-latitude study, and it is also likely that vulnerable methane deposits exist in other continental shelf zones around the world. So, departing once again from that article, what we're finding is careful scientific study, very little funding for this, but indicator is that we are in the midst of a horrific crisis, mega death crisis. And, you know, take a good breath, because you're going to enjoy that and remember it well, I do hope. Time is 9:33. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And Johnny's on the air.
Yeah, yep, I sure am. And first of all, I'd just like to hand out some gratitude. Really grateful for your emergency states of communication and bringing to the attention of the great devastation that we face exponentially every day. However, I don't know how to really how to challenge you, except for to say that I hear the chance of hope in your voice that we can change the direction that we're going in. However, I am certainly hopeful that that is true. But I've also, you know, I do a lot of research and I do a very high level of advanced spiritual discipline and in meditation and yoga and things that bring me in tune with the energies that flow around the cosmos. And the message that I'm getting these days is that, if you look at it in the state of addiction of consumerism that the world is in today, if you look at what it takes for an addict to recover, most addicts do not recover unless they hit the ground first, unless they fall out, hit the bottom. And that's what it's going to take for most of the addicted consumers around the planet today. We're going to have to hit bottom before we get it. But right before we all destroy ourselves, we'll get it, and then we'll move on to the next plane. And, you know, that may be our destiny. That may be what is going to move this human consciousness into its next step of evolution.
Well, if I sound optimistic, it's because, you know, actually, going back to my metaphor of the person stuck at the bottom of a pit and making inadequate progress out, you know, if that were me, and if cutting steps was all I could possibly think of, I would still cut the steps and I would, you know, die somewhat more satisfied that I had at least tried that. But what I'm saying is, if you can find a better way, then you best do that. Yell for help or something. Get out of this pit. You have to find a way that is actually going to work. And the Paris Agreement isn't going to do it. And if it starts something, then it's starting too little too late. And I hear what you're saying, though, and I respect what you're saying. If you feel that, then, I that may well be exactly how things will come down. But I think it's incumbent on us to, you know, just seize the day. And
There's no need to suffer. You know, there's no need for us all to suffer. You know, we can do something until that day comes. You know, I mean, there's no need to, I hear what you're saying, there is no need really for burying our head in the sand and just hoping that this cloud passes us by, you know.
Right on. And, you know, governments tend to think otherwise. Like, there's so many examples, but in the case of, say, the Fukushima disaster, the Japanese government over and over has tried to play it down. I mean, the thing that they're most terrified of seems to be not the radiation, but rather the people to actually take action on it based on the truth. And so they're constantly downplaying the truth. And, and nuclear power and nuclear disasters collaborate very nicely with that, because, as I said before, this being the fifth, we're getting into the fifth year after the disaster come next March, and that's when the human reaction to that much radiation starts becoming obvious, I'm sad to say. So they've been able to downplay it all this time. And global warming's the same sort of thing. I mean, really, our governments would much prefer that we not try to shake things up, but we have
right.
to.
Yeah, you're definitely correct about that. And you know, the one thing that that really comes to my attention is that they've learned long ago that bringing bad news keeps people scared and it keeps them in control. And if you notice, when things are going good for the powers that be, there isn't a lot of bad news out there. And so you can tell when they start getting scared, they start creating bad news. Mm-hmm. And so you can tell that they're scared. They know that they're not getting us anymore, and they're starting to have to create more and more and more news.
Yeah, they
and
need you scared so you can be controlled.
You know?
Absolutely, you're right about that. Thanks very much for your call.
All right, yeah, thank you for answering the phone. Have a great day.
Number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. I've been talking about the release of methane, and I've been talking about what a threat that is to your oxygen, but it's not the only one. It's just, let's say it's half of the threat to your oxygen from global warming, because a study led by Sergei Petrovsky, professor of applied mathematics, University of Leicester Department of Mathematics, has shown that an increase of water temperature of the world's ocean around 6 degrees Celsius, which some scientists predict could occur soon could stop oxygen production by phytoplankton by disrupting the process of photosynthesis. Global warming has been the focus of attention of science and politics for about two decades now, he says. A lot has been said. However, it now appears that this is probably not the flooding is probably not the biggest danger that warming can cause to humanity. About two-thirds of the planet's total atmospheric oxygen is produced by ocean phytoplankton, and therefore cessation would result in the depletion of atmospheric oxygen on a global scale. This would likely result in mass mortality of animals and humans. There's more on that, but I'm going to take a call from Sylvia right now. The number to call, 503-231-8187. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi, how are you doing, Teresa?
Doing well. It's nice to hear your voice. What's up?
Listen, I have explored this guy named Peter Hoff, and he has this thing called the tree solution, which he says he agrees with you about the Kyoto protocols and subsequent protocols not being effective and not changing what we need to change.
How do you spell his last name?
What?
How do you spell Peter Hoff's last name?
Oh, Peter Hoff, H-O-F-F.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, his solution is planting trees, and he has developed a technology to plant two seedlings side by side that will survive, maybe not be eaten by deer, but what he does is he believes that if we start planting trees, that is the solution, that we can cool down the global warming and that trees can release oxygen, store carbon, and be the solution. And even though it would take, I don't know, 5 to 10 years for those trees to grow, if everybody went out there in the next 2 weeks and planted trees, that would lower or cool down the earth. So
I still can't find it. Can you give me the spelling of the first name?
Peter, P I E T E R.
Got it. Okay, maybe that.
And his manual is downloadable for free on the internet, and it's called The Tree Solution.
Okay, teach plants to grow on arid places, anti-desertification, on a mission with Peter Hoff in Forbes. Okay. Groasis Waterbox. Okay, thank you very much for that information.
Well, I'm sorry, it's called Bioasis.
Bioasis, okay. All right, then.
All right, thank you, Teresa, for your show.
Thanks for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Not just flooding, but a huge reduction in the atmospheric oxygen that could produce the greatest threat to our life on Earth. And this, not just from the methane, but from phytoplankton. So we're talking about two models, displacement of oxygen by methane, displacement of oxygen by huge amounts of methane. The other, death of phytoplankton in the ocean because of acidification and warming. The little critters just can't hack it. University of Leicester researchers came to the conclusion after using a mathematical model to look at the effect of ocean temperature rise on oxygen production by phytoplankton. The conclusion, little critters are going to die. They explain how 70% of the oxygen in Earth's atmosphere comes from phytoplankton, photosynthesizing microscopic organisms that inhabit the sunlit topmost layer of nearly all our oceans and bodies of fresh water. The rate at which phytoplankton produces oxygen varies with water temperature, which is affected by global warming. For their study, the researchers formulated a mathematical model of the plankton oxygen process and how it responds to gradual ocean warming. The model takes into account basic interactions in the plankton oxygen process, such as oxygen production by photosynthesis, oxygen consumed by plankton breathing, and zooplankton feeding on phytoplankton, likely result in the mass mortality of animals and humans. So that's University of Leicester. Time is 9:43. You're listening to Press Watch. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. And Paul's on the air.
Hi, Teresa. This is your fellow KBOO talk show host. I just couldn't resist calling in briefly.
All right,
here.
Paul Rowland, expand.
Hi. Well, no, I just, you know, obviously, I think you know I share your sense of urgency about these things. I try to impart that in my own way on the air, but my concern, I guess, is obviously the thing that you're saying is taking down the the corporate oligarchy or whatever you want to call it, but how do we do that? And I sense that there's not even a very much of a willingness within whatever group you're talking about to seriously address that. So, like, that's the first part. Even say a place like KABU, are we ourselves, like, as a collectivity, getting together to discuss the sense of urgency and how best to bring it over the airwaves?
Well, I think that we have to look at, in what we do here, and which is certainly not a restriction of what you might do elsewhere, what we do here is we try to get out information and truth as best we can. And within reason, you know, I think there are also shows like mine in which I can simply issue polemics and say, I think this should happen, and look what will happen if this doesn't happen, and blah, blah, blah. So we're doing radio. And if we do radio well and we do it in the right way, and I think that the shape of the culture around us right now shows, we can have an effect. Now, I think, but you're speaking more than that, right, Paul? I mean, you're talking about, you know, what should societal groups do? You know, for example, maybe there would be an implication, what can we learn from and in spite of Occupy, what can we learn from Black Lives Matter? What works and what doesn't?
What new things might happen? We don't seem to really confront each other wherever we are. You know, any of the groups I've ever been involved in, there's an unwillingness to take it to the extent, if it is indeed as dire as you're saying it, it would require, like the person before said about addiction, you know, it's like, you know, have we not reached that bottom point? I mean, the bottom point that he seems to be talking about is the point beyond past no return. It's like we can't wait till that. Maybe we're already at that point. There just doesn't seem to be the sense of urgency to, you know, because say KABU, you know, KABU has the possibility of really doing a coordinated, you know, discussion of how to get together in a really urgent way and deal with this, but we're not even doing it there, or any of the other groups in town.
I think what you're describing is a reaction to the level of mind control that we do suffer in the society. For example, in the case of lowering oxygen levels, the government doesn't report when the radiation level goes up. I don't think they'd report oxygen. They don't now, and it would be against the interests of the people who are most benefited by the government, the people who, you know, donate or who create the government, the petroleum industry, to ever say what our oxygen levels are. And quite the contrary, I think once this, you know, starts happening in a big way, we would instead hear that, oh, there's a terrible problem with asthma, and people need to deal with their asthma and exercise more and blah, 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 and blame it on the victim. And it, you know, as long as our minds are controlled by the nonsense, we can't take action because we're paralyzed. And even here in KABU, you know, if we get together and we do the research, I mean, there's this island effect, and we have to, I mean, rationally, I think as human beings in a society, we have to ask ourselves, are we off on a tangent or are we onto something? We have to ask that constantly because there are so few community radio stations, there are so few community television stations. And this,
well, I just wanted to put that out there. I know I already get plenty of airtime, but thanks for taking my call.
Well, I appreciate you calling in.
Okay, bye.
Yeah, it's quite the question. And so I ask myself now, what can I do? So what I can do is find out the truth as best I can, analyze it with what resources I have available, and produce it on a radio show in a way that is comprehensible. And also to relay my emotion that not only is this, which comes from my gestalt, it comes from my consideration carefully of this situation, that we are in a severe situation, much more severe situation than we have been told, and that the actions that we need to take, just considering what you and I have to actually do at this point to turn things around, is mind-blowing. I think the closest thing that the United States society has felt to what we need to do would be World War II, in which we had rationing. We need a complete turnaround, and I think that, you know, when the question comes up what to do, the first thing that comes to my mind is, you know, as I've said many times, it hasn't happened in a really huge way for a long time, but this society has had general strikes. And a general strike is a peaceful refusal to go along with something that is destructive to you and to your society. General strikes have been held at times like these, when the economic distribution, when the distribution of wealth is so severely irrational and unequal, that you have the equivalent of billionaires. We do have billionaires now, I'm sad to say. And of course they're running society. It's a way of fighting against extreme concentrations of power and wealth. And wealth is how we express power. There have been other societies where power is expressed not just economically, but say religiously, or in terms of the status of a certain group of people, which is to be unquestioned. I'm talking about feudal and pre-feudal societies. So economic isn't the only way to do it, but always accompanies it. And the general strike, you know, it may be that, I mean, can you imagine all the other bus drivers saying, we're not going to drive buses today, because even though buses are, you know, probably one of the most efficient ways of getting people around using petroleum, we don't want to be part of this petroleum economy, and we want to bring everything to a halt so everyone can think about what we're doing and about how we need to do something completely different. If there were an interruption in the supply of petroleum to the major cities, then that would create a moment to think. It would, you know, doubtless create rage of people trying to get to work. But something has to happen to acknowledge the fact that we are in this crisis. And I don't want it to be the fact that people are having trouble breathing. And seriously, that is what we're looking at. As I've described over this past most of an hour, there is a huge threat happening now of the clathrate gun, which is runaway global warming and all of its effects, not just flooding, not just loss of the glaciers, but actual displacement of oxygen. That's how much methane can come bubbling out from our permafrost and from our oceans. And it has begun, and as I said before, methane creates global warming. And we're talking gigatons of release now. That is the amount. It has begun. We are in the clathrate gun. This is our lives. This is December 2015, and clathrate gun is happening. This is KBOO Portland. Now, secondly, as if the clathrate gun weren't bad enough, scientific research is showing that the ongoing death of phytoplankton from acidification and from the warming, you know, actually it doesn't say from acidification. It says from warming of water temperature. I just assumed it was from acidification. I'll bet it is, but I don't know that. So pardon me, I'll retract that. From global warming. From warming of the water, the phytoplankton are not thriving. They're dying, and they are responsible for producing and circulating into the atmosphere 70% of the Earth's oxygen. You know, the Earth's oxygen levels do fluctuate. In the Jurassic era, the amount of oxygen available in the atmosphere was far greater. If you're wondering how those giant critters, how they were able to get oxygen to every part of their titanic bodies, well, they had a lot more oxygen pressure to deal with. We don't have that now. It can change. And so we have these two sources, which are now affecting how much oxygen we are going to have available to us, and it is happening in an extremely rapid way. And the Paris Accords are going on, and as I've said, the Paris Accords' main effect, despite the intentions probably of most of the people there, despite the intentions of most of the people participating, the real effect and the real intention of the billionaires who control this is to distract and to keep the petroleum economy going, to avoid any but the most symbolic and cheap change, whereas what we really need is a World War II-like mobilization, trillions spent, which will have to be grabbed back from the super rich. They're going to have to give it up. Sorry, guys. You know, we'll leave some for you. But that's the extent of the crisis, and that's what should be happening now, and that's what we must demand. So the question is, what to do? Well, maybe general strike is a way to do it, but I will continue doing what I know to do, which is to tell you the truth as best I can find it. Number to call with the comments and questions, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187, and Natano is on the air.
Hey, Teresa, good show. Appreciate your sense of urgency on this matter. I was able to talk to Roger Rebell back in 92 before he died. He's the guy that, well, most people who's listening probably know who he is, but he's the guy that Al Gore thanked in the first minute or two of his Inconvenient Truth, because he's been working on this, or, you know, this issue for a long time. And I said, what's the solution? He says, you got to fix carbon. And a caller earlier said that trees would be, you know, the only way to do it. But actually, hemp fixes carbon at 2.5% efficiency, where trees are just over 1% efficiency. So,
well, but then you burn hemp, don't you? Or would you, like, convert it to rope? Are you talking about non-THC-producing hemp?
You just plant it. Doesn't matter what you do with it, it'll fix the carbon faster, twice as fast as trees.
Let me interrupt you. I'm sorry. I mean, it would matter what you do with it. I mean, if it were burned afterwards, then it would simply release the carbon back. So it could be used to sequester carbon. That's an interesting idea. And then it could be, like, set in a way, perhaps buried, to take the carbon away.
And so, or you could, you know, create it, turn it into biomass or something. But the main thing is you want to fix carbon as efficiently as possible. So that would be a priority. But I talked to Ross Gelbstein, who wrote a book called The Heat Is On, and this was like 20 years ago. And I said, what do you think the media has to do with this issue? And he said, nothing. And this guy reported for Boston Globe. And if you could take over Fox News for a day, you could change the situation overnight. You know, it's a matter of getting control of the media. And what we need to do is get like a rural radio initiative where we can get out into these red areas where Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Bill O'Reilly compete for the same time slot. And they don't, all they have is screech and preach. They don't have any real options. These people that, you know, always vote against themselves in these red areas. So the media has to, I mean, we have to somehow get an alternative source of media that's reaching these farmlands and these, these people that don't have access to things like cable or the internet. And until we can actually get our own, media message out there, it's going to be pretty grim in terms of turning the average American around, because all you hear, even from nauseating pasteurized radio, otherwise known as NPR, is that, well, there's still time and everything's, you know, don't listen to the wacko.
Nauseating pasteurized. Hey, thanks for that. Well, that gives me ideas. Why not? Now, this show is going to go onto the KBOO website and will be available on an audio podcast. So why not tweet that KBOO is broadcasting this sort of thing? Why not put that on Twitter? Let's use the cybernetic organization that we have available. Why not put it on Facebook? I'm at KBOO Press Watch on Twitter, and Teresa Mitchell on Facebook. So you can find it there. Thanks very much for your call. Running short on time for this broadcast. Once again, the main points, once again, are that global warming has progressed to the point that we are actually demonstrably in the beginnings of what is called the clathrate gun. It's not a hypothesis anymore. Those giant craters came from Pingos, which are clathrate blasts. The clathrate blasts are happening. We're talking gigatons of methane being released. We're in the thick of it. And the reason I talk about that displacing oxygen is because years ago, a little mathematical study was done that showed that if all of this were released, it would displace oxygen to the level that being at sea level would have oxygen available to an equivalent of being at 16,000 feet. Now, if you were to take me, you know, in my late 50s and put me at 16,000 feet, I would start choking. It would take me a couple of days. I'd black out and that'd be the end of me. There's a way around that. I don't mean to exaggerate. Of course, the treatment for that is you go up to 7,000 or 8,000 feet for a day, go back for 3 days, your body acclimates. But I'm just using that to show how extreme the situation is in terms of displacement of oxygen possible from methane clathrates. And there is a second mechanism for destruction of oxygen in the atmosphere from global warming, and that is the destruction of phytoplankton, which is ongoing now in a huge way. So this show is called Press Watch, and you've been listening to KBOO Portland, transmitting to you via the transmitter at 90.7 FM in Cascadia and other frequencies elsewhere, and via the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM, and in that manner to all the ships at sea.
Yes, you are listening to KBOO Portland, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com. Coming up in 15 minutes here on KBOO, it's Flashpoint, today honoring the life and times of noted Native American poet and spoken word artist John Trudell. The program includes an excerpt from a broadcast John Trudell did from Alcatraz in 1969. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Lynn Molick speaks with author Todd Davies about her latest book, The Lizard Princess, the third volume in the Arcadia Wonder Tales series. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, Barry Deutsch unveils his new graphic novel, the third in the Hereville series. It's called How Mirka Caught a Fish. That's all coming up this morning, right after Air Cascadia. Chris Andre is up next with headlines, interviews, and commentary on the Boo. Hey, thanks KBOO members for your generous support in our recent membership drive. You make this station possible. If you missed the drive, you can still give by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Thank you to all of our new and renewing members during our winter membership drive. That makes KBOO one of the best community radio stations in the country. We fell a few thousand short of our goal of 55,000, so if you didn't have a chance to give, it's never too late. Remember, for the month of December, if you become a new member or if you increase your giving over last year, your gift will be matched by a number of local businesses and individual donors. Donate now at kboo.fm/give. Thank you once again for being the best supporters a station could ever ask for.